Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans and freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Yes.
So this is, it has been a fascinating couple of weeks. We are doing our Sydney Film Festival wrap. We will be talking about some of the big films we have seen, including leading off with BlacKkKlansman, possibly the biggest film of the festival, and talking soon about the festival competition, things with trends, what we have thought of the festival more generally, and then going into some of the films that you may catch in cinemas, but that have screened and been prominent throughout that we caught over the final days of this year's Sydney 65th Annual Sydney Film Festival.
We're a little bit burnt out right now.
Yes, I'm exhausted. I think I've seen 45 films.
I saw 43.
Oh, I've seen 34.
Okay.
It's no shame, actually, Glenn.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel okay. So inadequate having seen 34 films in 12 days. Wow, this is the...
I don't know how I've done it. Or at least, actually, I can't recount... Like, I can't tell people, you know... That this is the guy to do the festival. I can't tell them that.
I can't say this is the way that you should do it.
No.
In the past, the maximum I've gone to has been like 33, 35-ish. And I'll say it's a testament to the quality of this year's festival that the films haven't started blurring together and disappearing from my memory. I can remember almost all of them.
Yeah. But also, actually, I think passing 40, it's almost like this kind of demigod divinity status that you achieve. That you're like, you know, oh my God, I now know what cinema is like.
They let you into that special corner at the hub that is like the 40-plus club. That,
yeah.
I did 41 one year, a few years ago, but it lapses if you don't, you know, keep it up.
Yeah, yeah. But it's okay. I wouldn't recommend it if people actually want to have a life. Otherwise, if you do love movies, it's okay.
Yeah, it's not really, as I've spoken about before on this program, the best way to appreciate some of these films because you're watching a lot of heavy, you know, weighty thematic films.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, very much so.
Yeah, and films that I think are really designed to have a lot of space to be digested and thought about, but because there's no other way to see them at the cinema, we cram them into these massive, relentless film festival scheduling. And, you know, instead of thinking about the film you've just watched, you're watching another one and then another one and then another one. So they really have to be incredibly your thing to stick in the mind.
Especially with Chris and I think, because we did almost all of the 3-hour-plus movies.
That's right.
Oh, dear, yeah.
Yeah, so it's...
We did, you know, yeah. I did 3 4-hour-hour films.
Yeah, fantastic.
Are you counting those as 2?
Yeah,
I guess if we did, then I'd be hitting 50.
But, wow. But it's also like, you know, a testament to my bottom for surviving that.
Cause, you know, the State Theatre chairs aren't that great, especially in the mezzanine. Like, I like it up top and in the dress circle, but they're not as comfortable as you'd hope.
I will give props to Dendy Opera Keys, especially in the aisle section.
Dendy's great.
Their sort of very padded wall has been a very comforting wall for me that I could lean and doze whenever I needed to in these 4-hour sessions.
Oh, God, the column in the State Theatre, I was so grateful for the American Animal screening. You could just lean up against it because you are running between film and film, and it is fun, and there's a good environment, and you see such quality stuff, and to the extent I think Chris alluded to it earlier, that even the really good stuff goes to the background when the really phenomenal stuff like Leave No Trace, or You'll Never Really Hear, just hits you out of nowhere.
Yep.
Ironically, these are interchangeable titles, Leave No Trace and You Were Never Really Here, because you left no trace. So, you know,
Leave No Trace could easily be called You Were Never Really Here, and it would be just as fitting a title, actually. And You Were Never Really Here could be called Leave No Trace.
That's fair. We will talk about those films as among our favorites later in the program.
One more thing when we're talking about the State Theatre and the endurance test of watching all these films. Look, I love the State Theatre. It's absolutely beautiful. It's great to be able to get in there at a low, low price of a Sydney Film Festival FlexiPass ticket and marvel at the architecture. But it's really not the best place to watch a film, especially subtitled films, because if you're in the stalls, it's not designed for cinema. It's an old-style theatre that's designed for watching elevated people up on a stage. Look, if you've got a tall person in front of you, and you're watching a 3-hour film, it's 3 hours of sort of...
Just in the stalls, though.
Just in the stalls. It's 3 hours of stretching up and around those people in order to read the subtitles properly.
I know why Chris brought it up, because I was sitting behind Chris's girlfriend and her hair wore was blocking out the subtitles, so I politely tapped her. And said,
yeah,
you should have come up to the dress circle. It's so nice up there.
Fortunately, all of these movies have so many walkouts that we were able to, you know, shift somewhere for Virat's benefit in not too long.
But also, I was very fortunate. You know, it would be really weird or awkward to tap a stranger and say, "Sorry, your hair is blocking out my subtitle view." I mean, that's a bit. I don't know how that would go.
Yeah. With the stalls, if you're at the back in the corner, it's terrible because like you can't see part of the screen. It's being blocked by the mezzanine above you.
Except, you know what? If you're in the stalls, and I love this, you can feel the train. You can feel the train beneath you, and it's such a nice feeling.
I've never noticed that.
Yeah, it happens every session. It's the St. James Museum line, and you can hear it just hum beneath you. Just a reminder, there's life outside of film.
Yeah,
as you've learned the past 24 hours.
And 4D experience.
As Godard pointed out to us, cinema and trains have always been intrinsically linked.
Oh, dear.
In the image book.
And in Mirai, which we will talk about later
in the
program. Yes,
indeed, in Mirai as well.
But first, we are talking about the new Spike Lee, Jordan Peele produced film, Black Klansman, which will have a general release in August. This was the first international public screening following the world premiere at Cannes. It stars David Washington as a real police detective based on the biography, so autobiography of the figure in the 70s, 80s, I'm not sure the exact time frame, where he was the first African-American detective in the Colorado Springs Police Department, and together, according to the film, with a number of the police detectives, including a local Jewish detective played by Adam Driver, they infiltrate the KKK, pretending to be one person, and actually rise pretty up in the ranks. And it is a comedic and dramatic look at their experience and this very interesting part of history. This was probably the major ticket item of the festival. It was certainly hotly anticipated. My feelings on the film are very mixed, but before I get into that, I'm curious to hear what the panel thought about Black Klansman.
I can sort of feel the ambivalence coming from Chris in an actual physical presence. But I totally get that. I understand where that's coming from. I mean, I'm thankful that we got a ticket because honestly, it was selling out.
Sold out fast.
You know, it was selling fast pretty much, I think, on the opening launch day.
Yeah.
When the films were announced.
Which is no easy task given that the website was barely allowing people to actually book seats for sessions at that point.
No, you're supposed to say positive things about the fest. Come on.
Plenty of positive things to say about the festival later, but next time, get the website working when you launch, guys.
Okay, some truth bombs. I'm talking about truth bombs. Black Klansman. Yes, it was hyped and very hyped, and people thought it was going to be a return to form of Spike Lee, the director who did films like Do the Right Thing, and you know, basically had a lot of energy and actually is a very inventive director in terms of how he actually directs cinema.
Yep.
And there's none of that in this movie. It's a very dull directed film, as if almost he doesn't care about direction. I mean, let's leave aside the actual film for a second. It's a boringly directed film.
Yes. Look, there is a standout sequence early on involving a sermon being delivered by a Black Panther member, and Spike Lee edits it so that
Corey Hawkins.
That's right. It's a great sequence. Spike Lee edits the film so that we're seeing a montage of the different faces of people in the audience responding to him, and I thought
like
that was
Queen in Bohemian Rhapsody style.
Exactly.
That's like the best director scene in the movie.
Disembodied black heads in the darkness. And I thought, you know, fantastic, right?
And then it becomes a Marvel movie.
Yeah, the way that that's shot really make it, you know, it's a nice way of visualizing people engaging with ideas and, you know, like this guy is like a beacon in the darkness spreading truth. It's actually a powerful sequence that I really enjoyed. But for the rest of the film, you can't see the guy who directed Do the Right Thing or She's Gotta Have It. It's basically anonymous in the way that it's made. And I think that style of direction and the boringness of that reflects the way that this film has been made in all aspects, because it's essentially a film lacking in any real personal identity outside of the times when the fourth wall is broken for addresses directly to the audience, like the sermon from the Black Panther member.
All right. There's a lot to criticize about this film. I agree with the substantive criticisms that come so far, including the fact that this is a very straightforwardly directed film, which is unusual, very unusual for someone like Spike Lee and those involved. I'm going to start with what I liked and appreciated about this film. The first half gains a lot of momentum, and it is very funny. It is certainly a novel and interesting premise, and Washington in, I think, one of his first major film roles deals with it exceptionally well. Adam Driver, even to a greater extent, he is, as we said earlier, a mark of quality, and he picks projects very well. He is one of not the best things about this film. In terms of its dealing with racism, it unpacks, I think, very significantly, and how you really see done on the film, how racism affects different communities and different people differently. As you referred to earlier, this predominantly deals with issues regarding members of the African-American community, as reflected by David Washington's character, and he certainly does undergo a pretty serious arc in terms of this film. However, separately to that and distinct from that, Adam Driver's character and his, in terms of his Jewish identity, also comes to terms with how the KKK and other like groups see him and has a process of self-actualization through this. Having said that, his arc's not as well as defined. It pretty much comes down to three scenes, including one very good speech, which is very well carried by Driver, but he did not get the arc as significant as Washington's character, even though both forms of very significant discrimination were dealt with very seriously, though not to this in the film, though to certainly not get this Driver's character certainly not get the same extent of treatment as the Washington character.
I thought that the treatment of Jewish identity was more interesting than the treatment of Black identity, because the crisis that Adam Driver's character goes through is something that's fairly novel on film. Whereas I think a lot of the points Spike Lee is making about Black identity and racism have been dealt with a lot already.
It's interesting with Driver's character, actually, because he doesn't care about his Jewish identity when the film opens. So it's actually an understanding of what he thinks identity is. And it's actually, you see a much more nuanced arc in that sense. Whereas I think a lot of African-American identity issues have been reduced to quotable slogans like Black Power or, you know, all power for all the people, which is, you know, fine in a sloganeering context, but I think often doesn't have the same kind of impact when you look at what kind of issues and self-perpetuated identity issues need to be unpacked as the film moves along. So I think you're right, you're quite right. Adam Driver's arc was way more interesting, if only it actually had a lot more substance, which never actually touched upon.
Going into the issues with the film, we're talking a lot about these sermon sequences. I think they're effective, and as is the way the film ends, which is a montage of real-life news footage.
That was the most effective aspect of the film.
I thought those were incredibly powerful, but it made me think that maybe Spike Lee should have made this into a documentary or a video essay so that he can address the audience directly with those points, because the actual narrative is pretty boring. The real-life case involved a lot of attempts to sabotage the KKK's, you know, propaganda movements without their knowledge, and I think that would be really interesting to watch the procedural of how they were able to pull that off. But instead, the movie is more interested in taking cheap shots. The KKK are basically cartoon villains. I think a more sophisticated approach to humor would be to have us laugh at these guys without overplaying the, you know, dumb characterization of these people. Like, it's in a way, it's strange when the film goes into Harry Belafonte telling us about the real life evil legacy of the KKK, because at that point the film is saying, hey guys, this is actually really, really serious. And before that point, you know, the KKK are basically, how would you describe it?
They're pantomime figures. And actually, this is interesting in that sense, because my biggest issue with this movie, and Glenn might agree with this or disagree, and I want to hear his thoughts, is that today or right now is not the time to depict KKK
Now
as
is
cartoonish
not the time.
Villains.
Exactly. Now is the time to depict them as being really, really scary and really, really evil in the force that they can have. But and the film had potential to do that with the characterization of one of the KKK members who's not a cartoon villain, who is racist in a low-key way, but portrays himself as just a regular, everyday American. That kind of figure, I think, is much more interesting. God, what else?
I mean, there's a lot to unpack about this film. In terms of the sermons...
Cheap shots against Trump. Oh,
and
God, I forgot that.
And that's what you want to get into. In terms of the sermons of this film, I appreciated... The speech given earlier by Corey Hawkins was very powerful. The one given by Harry Belafonte, which is contrasted with a speech given by David Duke character, who's depicted by Topher Grace, who I will get into his depiction in a little bit. I didn't appreciate the later speeches. I criticized, don't worry, he won't get far on foot earlier this week, because it had a use of a speech to essentially progress the plot and provide exposition. I think it was a similar effect here. I found that problematic. In terms of, and this was my biggest problem with the film, the quite blatant way, whether it's otherwise subtle, in terms of how it deals with historical figures and how it tries to deal with contemporary political crises. Now, And we haven't mentioned the very beginning of the film, for absolutely no reason, Alec Baldwin rocks up for a two-minute montage talking about racism in America from the perspective of a far-right person. And it's Alec Baldwin winking at the camera the entire time.
Ha ha, this guy played Trump.
Do you get it? Yeah, it wasn't very good at all. And I appreciate the political commentary they're trying to run with. However, some of the sequences, the reference to making America, the great, improving
let's
the greatness
make America,
of America.
Let's make him. He actually goes further than that. He says something about making it great again. And there's also endless repetitions of America first. And the film keeps repeating it as if, you know, as if we haven't got it the first time. Or references to, you know, maybe there'll be a political figure who'll ride on the wave of this racism, you know, but make it palatable to everyday Americans. No, surely that'll never happen. Wink, wink, wink. And the thing about the Alec Baldwin thing is it just plays into the criticism of the KKK members' depictions that I was talking about earlier. You know, this guy, we can laugh at this guy because of the stupidity of what he believes, or we could in a more sophisticated film. Instead of having this guy keep stumble over his words to create, you know, like a cheap entry point for people to laugh at him. Yeah,
I think the ending, the montage you alluded to, it very quickly and very snappily following a very... just tonally distinct ending tries to draw a more direct analogy with modern goings on, and
you can feel Spike Lee's anger there, but you can't feel that in the film preceding that.
That is very distinct. I mean, that was a political statement. It wasn't a narrative as we've seen Vince throughout the rest of the film. It's so tonally distinct.
That's exactly right.
And I'm surprised. Whereas Malcolm X and some of his other films achieved that quite more consistently, this did not.
Yeah, and. One look, I would challenge all the people who are saying they love this film so much and they really connected with it, a few of whom are people I really like and respect their opinions on, say, did you really actually care about, you know, the girlfriend character who's here to be a mouthpiece and the super undeveloped relationship? Or did you really actually care about the artificial suspense at the end that the film generates from a ludicrous concept that designed to bring Adam Driver and... what was his name?
David Washington's character, Ron.
Yeah, a ludicrous premise designed to bring themselves together. The film is so weak in terms of actual characterization and plotting, and I think the only thing people are really responding to is that there's a film in the mainstream that's calling out Trump.
But also, and this is something I have issue with, is the fact that this is a movie which is not actually a movie. It's trying to be a political statement, but it doesn't become a political statement or remain a movie. And it's somewhat...
It's not satisfying as a movie.
Yeah, it's called a no man's land. I mean, I would actually... You're right. Would like to see Spike Lee's anger. I mean, this is over the top, on the nose, but I would prefer it to be specifically on the nose if it wants to be that. And it doesn't want to be that for the majority of the film. So this idea when it actually does turn into this kind of, you know, here's what I'm trying to be, and becomes blatant, actually sort of jars a bit in your memory, because most of the film, it doesn't even care about its political message, and it shows this kind of full outrage for a lot of the film, which is kind of, I think, the problem with the left anyway.
He plays with a lot of blaxploitation imagery and in a kind of winky way. I don't feel like the attempts at being fun here cohere with the message we get at the end of the film at all. I think if the point of this film is get angry, you know, take action, then why are you playing down the threat? And can that actually work in the same film as all of these attempts to create something fun and accessible? I don't think Lee's pulled it off.
I think a lot of this comes down to how the Topher Grace chooses to depict Duke. And it is interesting that he does not portray the figure as cartoonish as some of the other people are depicted in the film. However, there's a crucial scene later where Duke confronts a member of the African American community, and that is where you can feel Spike's anger, and it is resonant, and you can feel the modern analogy with today is much more palpable. But I
wish
didn't
we had
feel
more of that.
And that was Black Klansman. It will be in cinemas come August. In terms of the rest of the festival, we had very recently the Sydney Film Prize handed out $60,000. Every single year, including the UNESCO City of Sydney Film Award, which went to Sweet Country director Warwick Thornton. However, in terms of the Sydney Film Prize, we predicted the other day whether The Seen and Unseen, Leave No Trace, one of the others would win, and it was totally wrong. It was something else entirely. What won the Sydney Film Prize?
Yeah, it was The Heiresses. I interviewed the director, Marcello Martinesi, and he's a lovely guy, and I'm happy he won the $60,000 for that reason, because it's nice to meet nice people in films. There's too many jerks. And also, I think...
Three on this panel.
Yeah, indeed. And he could also, I think, use this money because he made this film in Paraguay where there barely is a film industry, and he had to cast non-professional actors as for his story, which mostly involves elderly ladies, because there are barely any actors in Paraguay. So to make a movie mostly about old women, he had no choice but to cast people who'd never really acted in film before. So if there's anyone who could really take the money because of the lack of industry in his country, it would be an Australian filmmaker or Marcello Martinesi. Zing! Anyway.
But I'm glad Jerga didn't win. Because
I'm glad Jagger didn't win. I'm glad A Number didn't win. Look, I'm glad The Seed and Unseen didn't win. I'm glad Transit didn't win.
Just to be clear, joke about our lack of industry in Australia. I wasn't saying that the Jagger shouldn't win the prize, though apparently, because I never saw it, but apparently it shouldn't.
Oh, well, I was definitely not a fan. I think the depictions of some of the local issues encapsulated within that film were problematic. I also feel that while, yes, it is an avowed aspect to the production, that they got a camera in a Pakistani shopping mall and shot it with one camera operator and the actor Sam Smith, I think his name was, that showed, and I appreciate there's an aspect of productions like that where you shoot in Afghanistan to be DIY, but I certainly did not find, as much as I enjoyed the particular locales, I certainly did not find the manner of the production as engaging as it should have been given the content they were trying to evince.
So, well, the film and the crew, which probably are in most need of this kind of push and injection of money, and also made a decent product, let's not forget that, probably won the prize, which I think is a good balance.
Yeah, but on the case of The Heiresses, as a film, I didn't like it that much. I know some people have really connected and loved it, but for me, it's one of those movies that makes me wonder if I'm just too stupid for it, because it's so subtle. I would say it's actually too subtle. It's a film entirely of glances. It's about, it's about a bunch of old women. The central protagonist is Chela, her long-term partner, who she's in a lesbian relationship with, goes to prison because of debts, which are being called fraud. And so it's about her attempts to make money selling off her personal possessions, as well as running a taxi service with the social circle of people she interacts with. It's about her coming to grips with her lack of love for her partner and opening up to the other possibilities in her life. But it's so, 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 so restrained. For me, it was a struggle to actually pay attention and care about anything that was going on. I wondered if I wasn't sophisticated enough for this kind of filmmaking.
No, I feel... We've talked in terms of a few films, Tower of Bright Day, The Seen and Unseen, where subtlety cannot always work so well.
Better than Tower or... Or what was it, The Seen and Unseen? It's definitely better than those ones.
Yeah, I think Leave No Trace is certainly my highlight of the seven ones I've seen of the 12. I feel that struck a good balance. I would like it if it's one, but I appreciate that it went to someone who can very much use the money.
Yeah, I think it was notably weak competition that made me wonder what exactly is the criteria for these films. They say that it's about cutting edge or something like that. So I wondered if, for that reason, they weren't including some of the more established names in filmmaking, like Jafar Panahi and Nuri Bilge Ceylan, who had films at the festival that weren't included. But then they include Spike Lee, who's definitely got it made.
And even Miseducation of Cameron Post, which, everyone was going to see. And that's not restrained or cutting edge at all. It's quite on the nose.
Yeah, so I really don't get what it was about. I thought the films were mostly really, really weak, and some of the worst films I saw at the festival were in the competition.
And some of the best films I saw were not You Were Never Really Here.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
Don Quixote, which was flawed, but I enjoyed it for still pretty good. Part.
There was some tragic news today. Terry Gilliam lost the rights to that film, so we might have had just a rare opportunity to see this and this film at the Sydney Film Festival. So yeah.
People might never get to see it. So it's lost in the annals of...
Lost in La Mancha.
Lost in La Mancha, indeed.
Make another documentary about that, indeed.
But yeah, there are a lot of just drab art films in this, like One Day, not that interesting. What was some of the... Wajib was a highlight.
Wajib was fantastic. That's my favorite.
Yeah,
probably
Wajib, Leave No Trace were really good. Transit, I thought, was pretty good. Everything else was forgettable and in some cases amateurish, I thought it was a selection of the most boring films of the competition.
Well, one you have not mentioned, however, which I really did adore was Argo, which is actually heading to Argo's my hometown
good, actually.
Of Newcastle this weekend as part of the Travelling Film Festival.
Argo
heading
was
around the country.
Yeah, Argo is a pretty touching story of Inuit people, and it was one of the better ones for sure.
I'm glad actually Argo is getting travelling, because I think a lot of people can connect to it. It converges an audience favourite because it's actually a very warm and heartwarming story. And
definitely one of the better ones.
One ones to see on the big screen. Those are my two favorites from the competition, Argo and Leave No Trace. In the last few minutes, in our extended podcast edition, and you can download the podcast on iTunes and everywhere else, we'll be talking about several of the films we have caught and that may yet see a longer run in cinemas.
Mirai, The Wild Pear Tree,
Climax, The Ranger, The Guilty, The Danish Thriller.
So if you're listening to this on radio, seek out the podcast because we'll be talking about some better films than the ones we've discussed so far.
And if you're listening to us on the podcast, just keep listening. But in the last few minutes, so we'd like to talk about something actually quite serious as regards the programming for this year's festival. We're going to give a content warning prior. We'll be talking about the recurring theme of suicide within the Sydney Film Festival, and we will be later in the program be providing the number to Lifeline Australia. Now, we wouldn't normally raise this as an issue, however, it is remarkable from our perspective that of the films we have seen, we tabulated it, and for each of us, one third of the films had featured a strong, heavily strong theme of suicide.
Characters either committing or considering committing suicide. And I thought this was remarkable because I know that we're dealing with serious films, dealing with the heavier themes of life, but it surely says something about the times we're living in for there to be such an influx of films focusing on this theme right now. I really didn't know what to make of it. And it made, I think for Virat, it made getting to the end of this festival quite a struggle.
Yeah, I sort of bore the worst brunt of it because I think my number went up to more than one third. So by the end of it, it just felt like I was emotionally exhausted. I think I'd given everything, and you know, coming out of it, every screening, it just felt like an endless kind of loop of is that where we're at? You know, and I wasn't able to place whether there is, you know, is where the arts community is feeling this way, whether the world is feeling this way or young people are feeling this way, what's happening? And it just kind of made me feel very sort of sad for the world.
And I will say that I don't think this was a deliberate programming choice by the Sydney Film Festival. It's just a recurring theme that happens to be feature in memory prominent texts and films lately. Certainly 13 Reasons Why featured very prominently on Netflix in the past year.
Yeah. If we just take this as the Sydney Film Festival as a survey of what's going on in film, it definitely shows people's thoughts are in a very, very dark place. When Virat just alluded to is that just how the arts community is feeling, I definitely think that with the spread of the far right, the arts community is feeling that maybe their time is coming to a bit of an end. There are a lot of films, moving a bit away from suicide just for a moment, there are a lot of films about worlds that are shrinking and disappearing. Aga and the RSs of just films in the competition were both about that.
Ex Labourers as well. Which
is this also just how filmmakers feel about the world of cinema coming to an end?
I mean, just look at arts criticism and actually film critics. I mean, the full-time film critics have been reduced to, in Sydney, I think only...
Just us. This is the best you can get, guys.
No, two or three at least, the one who are doing full-time and getting paid for it.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, it's bleak news all around.
Look, the film festival opened with a video of a zombie and asking for more funding for the festival. Please donate so that you can keep this festival alive. The cinema is undead, jokes write themselves. I think everyone's feeling a little bit sad about the state of cinema these days. So, I noticed that the audience is getting older and older with every year. I'm seeing less and less young people. So even though the festival showed many great films and in many ways was one of the best Sydney film festivals I've ever gone to, it did lead us to pretty sobering thoughts about the state of the world, the state of people's mental health, and the state of cinema.
Returning to just some of the specific examples of this issue within film, I think especially seeing as this is recurring more frequently, it's very important how this is depicted. And I'd like to raise two examples. One is, I won't say which one, but one of the Joaquin Phoenix films which featured at the festival had a very similar scene to the film I saw on opening night, Ghost Stories. I feel the Joaquin Phoenix film depicted this issue with a great deal. It was very graphic, very visceral, but it depicted it with a great deal more maturity. In the Ghost Stories, it was used as a plot device, an unnecessary one, and had a very poor rounding off to its ending. So I think as we are seeing this increasingly more, I think it's very important, particularly in the films we seek out and then when people are making films, that it is... if the issue is explored, is it explored maturely and well? I want to thank everyone for, I guess, we talk have a lot of reverence in this program, but it is good to talk about a serious issue and unpack what is a very significant and I think increasingly significant issue within cinema. If you are experiencing issues and you do want to speak to someone, we strongly encourage you to do so, and you can always contact Lifeline Australia on 131111. 1314. The number is 1314. We'll be back on our podcast talking about some of the extra films we've seen at the Sydney Film Festival. And next week, getting back to regular cinema of all things.
Yeah, blockbusters, Incredibles 2, Hereditary, which is a blockbuster, I guess, for cinephiles, but not for the general audience.
And other movies.
And other movies. So this has been
Always more movies. That's what we've learned.
So this has been Glenn Falgenstein, Chris Evans, and Virat Nehru. Enjoy movies. Have a wonderful evening and good night.
Enjoy 50 movies.
Oh, it's unbearable there. among the towering reeds. Out in the blue, we both bowed in the breeze. And all that music, it was all far to me. Wasted you like a prayer in the wind. All holy and wasted, honey. Prayer.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's a crying shame. Now you can feel my heart. Nothing without love.
skin, the skin, the skin. Skin. If you need a love.